From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a New York doctor tests positive for Ebola. Should the international community focus on source nations of Ebola?
I don't think there's any choice. This is a security threat to West Africa and beyond.
Police chase corrupt Chinese officials in Australia. And Canada's parliament reflects after Wednesday's shooting. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. A New York City doctor who recently treated Ebola victims in Guinea has become the first person in the U.S. city to be diagnosed with the virus. Mayor Bill de Blasio confirmed the case late Thursday, saying Dr. Craig Spencer has been placed in isolation and there is no cause for alarm. Spencer on Thursday notified the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, where he worked, that he had a high fever and was nauseous, two symptoms of Ebola. Officials are looking for anyone who may have had contact with Spencer. He would be the fourth person diagnosed with Ebola on U.S. soil. Andrew Cuomo is the governor of New York. He spoke today with NBC Television's Matt Lauer.
Once Dr. Spencer identified himself, did officials here do what they needed to do in a timely fashion and exercising the proper protocols? Are you confident in that?
As confident as one can be, Matt. You know, with... You're right. This is a situation that we hoped wouldn't happen, but we expected that it would. It is New York. People come through here. We also had the advantage here of notice. Dallas really had no notice. We all watched what happened in Dallas. So we have been preparing literally for weeks on a coordinated effort plan between New York City, New York State, federal government, CDC. We had just done a training with 5,000 healthcare workers. A healthcare union has been fantastic. And this was a doctor. So the doctor was familiar with the disease. And again, this is not like the flu. It's not airborne. It's not from people sneezing. The person has to be symptomatic, and it's basically transferred through bodily fluids.
Yeah, but you say
so
it's a doctor who was familiar with the disease.
He wasn't symptomatic.
I apologize for interrupting. You say it's a doctor who was familiar with the disease, and yet you heard that gentleman at the end of Katie Turr's piece saying, well, if you're so familiar with the disease, you know you've been treating Ebola patients in Guinea, you come back to this country, do you ride the subways? Do you take an Uber car? Do you go to a bowling alley? Do you think Dr. Spencer acted responsibly?
Look, I'm not a doctor, Matt, but the flip side of what you just said is if you're a doctor, you know you're not contagious until you're symptomatic. This is a doctor who was taking his temperature twice a day and obviously concluded that he was not symptomatic, and that's why he went out, still in a limited way. He went bowling with two friends. He was with his fiance, and he took the subway. But he obviously felt he wasn't symptomatic. He knew that was the only time it was contagious. As soon as he had a fever, he presented himself to the hospital. All the procedures thereon were exactly according to the book. The first responders did a magnificent job. The healthcare workers did a magnificent job. So everything has happened the way it should happen since then. We've been in contact with the federal officials. President Obama called last night. Ron Klain, the new Ebola czar. Sylvia Burwell, head of Health and Human Services. So everything worked the way it should. And our hope and our belief is that the doctor who was familiar,
right,
wasn't symptomatic. That's why he left the house and wasn't contagious when he's not symptomatic.
Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York, speaking on NBC's Today Show. The United States is forming medical teams that will rush to any part of the country where a new Ebola case is suspected. The Centers for Disease Control Ebola Response Teams, or CERTs for short, are made up of experts who are specially trained to diagnose and treat Ebola. Preparatory teams called Facility Assessment and Support Teams, or FASTs, will check hospitals that have volunteered to treat Ebola patients to make sure they can handle an Ebola case. VOA's Latika Hoke has details.
Each rapid response team consists of about 20 members who will be ready to depart within hours to any part of the United States where a patient has been diagnosed with Ebola or is highly suspected of infection.
Well, the rapid response teams are meant to assist hospitals that see suspect Ebola patients. The response teams consist of specialists in infection control, clinical medicine, Ebola outbreak investigation, communications, and a variety of other disciplines, including laboratory.
President Barack Obama ordered the formation of specialized teams after the first Ebola case diagnosed in the United States showed that most hospitals are not prepared to handle the virus. The patient who arrived from Liberia was treated at a hospital in Dallas, Texas, but died on October 8th after infecting two nurses who took care of him. The case caused fear that Ebola may spread in the United States, and many Americans have accused health officials of not being prepared to deal with the virus. Mr. Obama said rapid response teams will ensure that proper procedures are applied in all suspected Ebola cases.
If we do these protocols properly, if we follow the steps, if we get the information out, then the likelihood of widespread Ebola outbreaks in this country are very, very low.
The president sought to allay the fears that the deadly virus would spread in the United States. The decision to deploy an Ebola response team will ultimately be made by the CDC director at the request of a hospital or clinic that may need it.
Our emergency operations center has been activated. I think we're in our 106th day of our activation. So the decision to deploy a CDC Ebola response team would lie with the incident management structure. Now, our emergency operations center is our director's operations center. So, of course, all decisions ultimately sit with Dr. Frieden.
Team members are drawn from a list of about 100 health workers scattered across the country. Three fast teams already have been sent out to New York, Chicago, and Washington. No search teams have been deployed yet, but the first group of 20 is on standby with their bags packed. Latissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Dr. J. Stephen Morrison is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of West Africa's Galloping Ebola Crisis. We asked him how prepared for the spread of Ebola are the major world powers.
The major powers in the world are all scrambling to prepare themselves for dealing with Ebola. It was not until very recently that they had to countenance the very real possibility that Ebola might be landing on their shores. And so the preparations that are needed in terms of the screening, the contact tracing on cases, the infection control procedures, the protective gear that people need to wear, the public communications, all of the key interventions that need to be brought into force, the protocols, the training, the handling of contaminated waste, those are things that are complicated, that require intensified training and practice. And I don't think that most of the major powers have gone through the full drill, the full spectrum of exercises that are needed, and yet they realize this is a very real threat now with the increased importation of cases of Ebola into Europe and North America and elsewhere.
If the world powers are scrambling, what does that mean for the developing world?
The developing world, the countries that are in greatest peril at the moment are those that, other than those that are fighting this, the Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, complex of three countries that are beset by this runaway epidemic. The states that are at greatest risks are those that are in the immediate neighborhood, and those are Senegal, Nigeria, Ghana, Mali, and others. They are ones where, and Cote d'Ivoire, these are countries where there's quite a bit of traffic coming by foot, by road, by air, by sea, and Senegal and Nigeria have both handled cases, have been tested in their ability to manage and respond to the entry of contagious and highly symptomatic individuals with Ebola, infected with Ebola. Nigeria mobilized on a considerable scale. Senegal did the same. They've proven themselves able to bring them under control and after a period of time to be ruled free of Ebola. They're not out of the woods in the sense that they still remain vulnerable. As the epidemic in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea continues to mushroom, the numbers of cases are expanding exponentially. Every 20 days, the epidemic is doubling. It's expected there'll be 10,000 new cases per week in December, and there are projections that are rather staggering projections as to what the aggregate number of cases may look like when we get into the new year, upwards of 1.4 million. As that human base increases, of course, the risk increases that there'll be increased export of cases into the surrounding region and beyond.
Some people suggest that Ebola should be attacked at its source, that the international community should pour money into these nations where the Ebola virus seems to be affecting the most people. Do you agree with that?
I don't think there's any choice. This is a security threat to West Africa and beyond. The UN Security Council has passed a motion declaring that. Statements have been made by many world leaders, including President Obama, affirming this, that this is a public health crisis that has transmuted into a major global security threat. It has to be. There is no choice on ethical and on security grounds that those countries with the capacity to lead, like the United States, the British, and others, need to step forward and make major commitments. What we've seen in the last period is major commitments coming from several countries. The United States has been the boldest and the most dramatic in the commitment of now upwards of 4,000 U.S. troops, up to $1 billion in military assistance, over $350 million in civilian agency assistance, predominantly directed towards Liberia. The British are making a very dramatic commitment into Sierra Leone, 750 troops, £300 million of commitment into Sierra Leone. The French are doing something similar in Guinea. The World Bank has responded with over $400 million in emergency facilities. IMF is promising to be supportive. The EU has come in with 130 million euros in support. But the UN operation, which is meant to be to grow into being a multilateral coordinated effort for all three of the countries and some of the neighboring countries if they face infections. The UN mission for emergency Ebola response, UNMEER, which is basing itself out of Accra, Ghana, is struggling to get adequate commitments and pledges. There is a struggle. There are gaps. There's the need to do a lot more. We have to move on a very large scale and very quickly.
Dr. J. Stephen Morrison, Senior Vice President and Director of the CICE Global Health Policy Center. Monday, we'll speak with him about locking down borders and preventing flights out of the hardest-hit Ebola nations. Pakistan is the only country where the polio virus is still spreading fast. This year, 208 cases of paralysis were recorded, accounting for 85% of the worldwide victims. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad that the country is coming under extreme pressure to contain its infections and boost vaccinations or face isolation.
The number of children paralyzed by the polio virus in Pakistan this year is the highest since 2000, when authorities recorded 199 cases. Aisha Farooq, who heads the Prime Minister's Special Polio Eradication Cell, says the government is approaching the problem with what she calls a war footing.
The government at all levels is making a renewed commitment to work towards making the upcoming low transmission season to be the last that Pakistan hopefully gets to see. Just as Pakistan threatens the world in spreading this virus, our own high-risk areas threaten spreading the virus to safer areas of Pakistan.
Pakistan launched emergency polio eradication efforts in 1994. Over the next decade, the number of cases dropped from around 25,000 to just 28. But new infections still persisted and now are increasing, in part because Islamist militants have hampered vaccination campaigns. Ilyas Durre, the World Health Organization's Senior Emergency Coordinator for Pakistan's polio program, warns that by the end of this year, the country is likely to become the only one still spreading the virus globally.
If we miss this next year, then we will be really in a deep hole that it may be very difficult for us to come out. And more variables may come out and drag us more into not being able to finish it. But this is the only chance where Pakistan can say this is the last chance.
He emphasized the need for enhanced immunization efforts in Karachi, where the polio virus is now showing up in sewage samples taken from all over the largest Pakistani city. Pakistani officials acknowledge there have been management and accountability problems in its polio vaccination program. But Aisha Farooq says security has become the gravest challenge, with 90% of new cases in what she calls security compromised areas.
These are areas where there was either a ban, there is a ban. These are areas where you have active militancy, or these are areas where our polio teams have been threatened, they've been attacked. And by the way, Pakistan is the only country in the world to have lost more than 64 people, both polio vaccinators as well as police escorts, providing them security to this war against polio.
Officials say that the security challenge magnified in 2011 after it was revealed that the CIA organized a fake hepatitis B vaccination drive as a cover to try to gather evidence from Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden's hideout in Abbottabad. In 2012, the Pakistani Taliban banned vaccinations in their strongholds of North and South Waziristan. Pakistan and World Health Organization officials say the ban deprived as many as 350,000 children of polio vaccination for 2 years in a row, turning the Waziristan territory into the biggest polio sanctuary in the country. Pakistan Army has been conducting major counter-insurgency operations since June to rid the border region of militants. The fighting has forced tens of thousands of tribesmen to flee to nearby cities. Pakistani WHO officials attribute the jump in the number of cases this year to the sudden influx of so-called internally displaced persons, or IDPs. Farooq, however, says the situation has also offered an opportunity.
Since the exodus of the IDPs from Waziristan, to date we have been able to vaccinate 750,000 IDP children. So they're very hopeful that this polio sanctuary, which was Waziristan area, which was completely inaccessible because of the ban, this recent operation has given us a hope, the program, a capital opportunity to target those children that out of no fault of their own, we were not able to reach and vaccinate.
WHO's country representative, Dr. Michel Taghin, says he's optimistic Pakistan can bring the polio outbreak under control.
We should be concerned but not afraid about the situation of today. We know that vast majority of those children are children that haven't been reached out for the past 1 or 2 years in some regions. We still believe and we are confident that we can eliminate polio of Pakistan next year, or at least put Pakistan in a situation where elimination will be very obvious and very quick.
Pakistani officials say families across the country continue to refuse vaccinations because of religious, medical or other misconceptions attached to the polio vaccine. Imtiaz Ali Shah heads the polio program in the violence-hit northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, where most polio cases are located. Shah says health workers still are struggling to help families understand why polio immunization is more important than more common diseases such as diarrhea and pneumonia that sicken and kill many children in Pakistan.
So that is basically a confusion in their mind that at one hand the government is coming to our doors or houses and vaccinating our children and protecting them from a disease that is yet not caused to them, and they are not providing any services when we are ill and when we need the services.
Pakistani officials say a so-called Polio Plus plan is being devised to bring some of the basic health facilities and benefits to the targeted communities to help remove some of the misperceptions and encourage them to get their children vaccinated against polio. WHO officials also believe that by strengthening its national polio eradication system, Pakistan can also keep out the Ebola virus. This method was used to great success in Nigeria, where authorities turned polio campaign operation centers into emergency offices that helped stop the Ebola outbreak in a short period of time. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
An international police operation is targeting corrupt Chinese officials who fled to Australia with an estimated $1 billion in bribes and embezzled money. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
China has enlisted the help of several Western countries in a far-reaching anti-corruption campaign. Within weeks, Australian authorities are expected to seize the assets of seven of China's most wanted economic criminals. It's part of China's Operation Fox Hunt that began in July and is now targeting former communist officials who've relocated to the West, often under assumed identities. They're accused of stealing vast amounts of money from the state. Sean Rain, the managing director of the China Market Research Group, says several suspects posing as wealthy businessmen have been allowed to resettle in Australia's biggest city.
When you go into Sydney, you know, a lot of the $10, $20, $30 million properties are being bought by Chinese with connections to officialdom. These people are not the prize that a lot of Australians had hoped for, and that they're really corrupt. They're not necessarily the type of business people that you want as part of your community.
There's no extradition treaty between Australia and China, but Canberra can consider such requests for offences falling under the UN Convention Against Corruption. Australian police believe potential suspects include naturalised Australian citizens who've laundered money for years, pretending the funds were genuine business investment from China. The Australian Federal Police has said it has successfully confiscated the proceeds of crime from Chinese economic fugitives. The Washington-based Global Financial Integrity Group, which researches the illicit flow of money, estimates that more than $1 trillion was illegally channeled out of China from 2002 to 2011. Despite the anti-corruption drive, Australia last week announced measures to attract more investment from wealthy Chinese, including speeding up visa approvals and expanding investment opportunities. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
It was a somber day in Canada Thursday, the day after a lone gunman killed a soldier standing guard at Canada's National War Memorial before firing shots and running into Parliament in the capital, Ottawa. Crowds gathered at the war memorial to honour Corporal Nathan Carrillo. Police have identified the gunman as 32-year-old Michael Zahef Babau, Canadian-born and might have held Libyan citizenship as well. Some Ottawa residents, like Cher Scott, were angry about the attack.
The young man that died did nothing. He did nothing to deserve what he got, and I am so angry at the man that shot him.
The heart of Ottawa had been in lockdown after Wednesday's attack, with fears that other gunmen might be on the loose. Police now believe the gunman acted alone. He was in Ottawa applying for a passport to travel to Syria, according to Canadian Police Commissioner Bob Paulson. Jack Harris, a Canadian member of Parliament, said security in Ottawa will change in the aftermath of the attack.
Obviously, it was a vulnerability that this individual was able to penetrate. Clearly, that's not going to be allowed to happen again. You know full well there will be a massive major review by all relevant forces and officials, and we would expect that certain changes would be made.
Members of Parliament Thursday honoured 58-year-old Sergeant-at-Arms Kevin Vickers, who confronted and shot the gunman just outside the parliamentary caucus rooms. Prime Minister Stephen Harper paid tribute to those who made sacrifices for the well-being of others.
We are so fortunate to have people like this. The past couple of decades has, you know, we see across the world increasing places where the planet is descending into savagery. And there are people who, every day of their lives, stand on guard for this country and for all of us. And we obviously want to convey our gratitude to these two servicemen and their families, but also to all the people who undertake this extremely dangerous work on behalf of the world.
Prime Minister Harper went on to say that Wednesday's incident will not take Canadians to their knees.
We'll be vigilant, but we will not run scared. We will be prudent, but we will not panic. And as for the business of government, well, here we are in our seats, in our chamber, in the very heart of our democracy and our work.
Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper was speaking Thursday before members of Parliament. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On October 24, 1648, the Treaty of Westphalia was signed, ending the 30 Years' War, one of the most destructive conflicts in European history. Fought mainly on German soil, this series of connected wars began when the Austrian rulers, the Habsburgs, tried to impose Roman Catholicism on their Protestant subjects in Bohemia. Eventually, commercial interests and power politics drew most of Europe into the fray. When signed after 4 years of negotiations, the treaty ended the prospect of a Roman Catholic reconquest of Europe. It also bestowed independence on Switzerland and the Netherlands, recognized the autonomy of the German states, and granted new territory to France and Sweden. Today, the treaty is recognized by historians as initiating the era of modern diplomacy. October 24th is celebrated as United Nations Day. On this day in 1945, a month after the end of World War II, the United Nations Charter was formally enacted. The new global institution's stated goal was to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedoms. 4 years after the UN was established, the cornerstone for the permanent headquarters of the organization in New York was laid on this day in 1949. On this day in 1951, President Harry Truman proclaimed that the nation's war with Germany, begun in 1941, was officially over. Fighting had ended in the spring of 1945, but a treaty was not signed at that time. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is committed to supporting efforts by the governments and people of the Arab Peninsula to end the threat posed by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP. As part of that support, we are offering rewards totaling up to $45 million, leading to the locations of the terrorist group's 8 key leaders. AQAP was formed in 2009 by Yemeni and Saudi terrorists under the leadership of Nasir al-Wahishi, who headed a predecessor Al-Qaeda group in Yemen. It has conducted many high-profile terrorist attacks against the Yemeni government, U.S., and other foreign interests. In March 2009, an AQAP suicide bomber killed 4 South Korean tourists and their Yemeni guide. A few months later, AQAP dispatched a suicide bomber who attempted to detonate an explosive device aboard a Northwest Airlines flight over the continental U.S. Other attacks followed. Rewards are offered for Nasir al-Wahishi, AQAP's top leader, responsible for approving AQAP targets, recruiting new members, allocating resources, and directing attacks. In 2013, Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri named him as his deputy. Also, Qasim al-Rimi, a senior AQAP military commander who has played an important role in recruiting AQAP operatives. Ibrahim Hassan Tali al-Hasiri is AQAP's primary bomb maker. He gained notoriety for recruiting his younger brother for a failed suicide bomb attack against Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Nayef in August 2009. Shaki Ali Ahmed al-Badani is an AQAP leader and operative. He played a key role planning a major attack that led the United States to close more than 20 diplomatic posts in the Middle East and Africa in the summer of 2013. Jalal Balaidi is an AQAP regional emir involved in 2013 with planning bomb attacks on various Western diplomatic facilities and personnel. Others being sought are Ibrahim Rubayash, a senior AQAP Sharia official and advisor who provides the justification for the group's attacks, Ibrahim Albana, the group's chief of security, and Othman al-Ghamdi, who has helped raise funds and stockpile weapons. The U.S. guarantees that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. The tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.